Welcome to Dad's on the Air for the 3rd of July 2007. I'm Greg Andreessen, and in the studio with me today we've got Ian Purdy, of course, author of the of the Daddy Split Guide.
Well, that got a good hack out of you, Greg.
Yeah, sorry, I should have used the cough button. Now, the Daddy Split Guide is now available on the internet at lulu.com, so go check that out. We've also got rock and pop Peter Vandervoort in the studio.
Morning, Greg. Another rockin' show.
And John Stapleton is away. It's a school holiday, so lucky John's off camping in the bush somewhere with his
kids. We don't know where he is. He's somewhere between the Bahamas and Broken Hill.
But he bought a note from his mum, so we let him off the hook.
Yep, and he couldn't even get mobile phone coverage, so he couldn't even phone in, so he's really having a holiday. Good on him. Well, look, a couple of weeks ago, I went down to Canberra with about 30 other delegates from around the country and attended a great event. It was called the Men's and Fathers Family Friendly Policy Forum. It was on the 20th of June at Parliament House, and we talked to ministers and shadow ministers and backbenchers from Liberal Party, Labor Party, Nationals, Family First, and it was really exciting to get this great bunch of people from all over the country together talking about the health and well-being of men, fathers, and families. Now, one of the Labor backbenchers actually, to our surprise, got up in the House of Representatives that evening and gave a really nice talk in federal parliament about our presentation. I might just read a little bit from his speech. That was Mr. Anthony Byrne, the late Labor MP, and this is what he said. He says, "I rise tonight to talk about my impressions of a forum that I actually addressed the main committee about this morning. I was so impressed by what I experienced in that forum that I thought I would share with the House my experiences and those of the other members of the opposition who attended. This was the Men's and Fathers Family-Friendly Policy Forum. There were 33 delegates from around Australia, academics, authors and people that provide social services, and the function was under the auspices of the Fatherhood Foundation, whose director is Warwick Marsh." He says, "We were all incredibly impressed with the insights that we gained, particularly of those of us in Breakout Group 1, and that some of the MPs that were there were Roger Price, Jenny George, John Hogg and himself. The issues that were dealt with were education, health, family and community, birth rates, demographics and general issues concerning boys, men, fathers and grandfathers. There were four presenters there. Maggie Hamilton, who we've had on the show.
Yeah, she was very good.
She's a great presenter.
Great knowledge of the subject.
Absolutely. She wrote the book What Men Don't Talk About. She gave a great presentation. Judy Geggy, who's director of the Family Action Centre at the University of Newcastle. She works a lot with boys' education. She was there. Professor John McDonald, who we've also had on the show before.
We have, yes.
The great Scotsman. He talked about men's health and suicide, and I actually gave a talk too about the need for the government to bite the bullet and actually get together an office for the status of men and fathers.
And what was your impression, Greg? Body language, and did you really get the impression they were listening, that it was actually getting through to some of them who pay a lot of lip service but don't actually put that into plans or propositions to change some of the terrible things that are happening?
Yeah, look, it's always hard to know. I mean, politicians, their job is to give platitudes and say the right things, and, you know, they probably say lovely things to everyone who comes down there, but there are a couple of encouraging signs. The first thing was we talked to the main ministers and shadow ministers from both sides. They could have easily just said, look, we're too busy, it's a sitting day of parliament, we're not going to come. So sure, the fact they actually turned up, that's really great.
Yeah, that's a plus.
That's a good sign.
Shows that they're taking us seriously. Second thing was there was some really interesting comments. One of the Labor MPs, who is a old-school gender feminist, actually came up and said, look, I can really see what you guys are talking about. This takes me back to 30 years ago when we as women were sort of fighting for our rights. And
yes.
And I can sort of really see that there's some parallels there, and that was really good to hear someone who's really staunch and maybe we thought was set in her ways actually thinking, well, you know, seeing the light bulb switch.
Well, our own John Stapleton was in that movement too, pro-feminist, back when he was going to university. So was Warren Farrell and many of the spokesperson. Persons around, they are all ex-feminists.
Erin Prizzi as well, another major.
That's right.
Another one.
That's right. And they all started out thinking and believing that feminism was all about equality. And for a lot of them, it was. It just sort of taken this strange turn along the way. And
it's
now
about dominance now, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, now we've got to sort of swing that pendulum back towards men.
Men got left behind. I think that's what it was. They became more and more equal until we weren't equal anymore.
Equality. We became invisible.
Yeah.
Now, moving on, the New South Wales government, the RTA, has brought out a new ad campaign targeting, it's an anti-speeding campaign targeting young men, and it's been nicknamed the Pinky Campaign. Ian, what do you make of this?
Oh, well, it's pretty ridiculous, isn't it? I mean, what they're basically encouraging people to do is to waggle your little finger anytime you see somebody driving in a manner that you deem to be inappropriate or dangerous or hooning or something. You're supposed to wave your little finger at them, which is supposed to imply that they've got a small penis. Besides being puerile and obscene, this particular campaign will only serve to incite violence. I mean, how is a normal, virile young man supposed to react to such an obscene gesture from somebody waiting in a bus shelter as he drives past in his sleek, shining status symbol? Surely many healthy young thugs will simply pull up and demonstrate the quality of their testosterone by bashing whoever is dared to cast aspersions on their manliness. And taking this a step further, what happens when somebody does get bashed for using this offensive gesture? Won't the government then be liable for inciting violence? I'd like to make the point here that really only the truth hurts. Those of us who are normally too well endowed are not going to take such a puerile gesture seriously. The only logical conclusion I can reach is that the desk-bound bureaucrat who dreamed up this stupid campaign considers this particular gesture to be especially hurtful because he has a very small penis. And what are you supposed to do if it's a woman driving in a manner that you find offensive? I mean, what, for example, would you do if the old ex-Federal Sex Discrimination Commissioner, Prue Goward, who has recently been convicted of speeding through a school zone and through a stop sign, two offences she has actually been convicted of. I mean, what are you supposed to do in her case if she roars past you? I mean, implying that she has a small penis doesn't strike me as a particularly effective strategy. Perhaps somebody could invent a gesture that implies that she's got a fat ass. The entire campaign is disgracefully sexist. It only applies to people with penises who all happen to be men. From this, are we meant to assume that women don't commit traffic offences? This campaign is unbelievably dumb. It was ill-conceived and utterly irresponsible. It will do nothing to improve people's driving skills or their attitude. The fact that the New South Wales government has funded it is a sad indictment of the calibre of the people who are running this state. Why don't they use our money to do something useful? Anybody who has driven over the Harbour Bridge lately couldn't fail but notice how degraded the road surface of this national icon has become. It wrecks your car to drive across the Sydney Harbour Bridge. Surely the money being wasted to shove this drivel in our faces via television would cover the cost of resurfacing the Sydney Harbour Bridge. But no, our taxpayer money has to be wasted encouraging people to publicly give each other rude gestures.
Thank you very much. I think you don't think you'll have much disagreement from the rest of us in the room. Rock and Definitely Pop, you've got a little story there on a dad who was jailed for waving at his daughter, is that right?
That's right. There's plenty of interesting stories coming out of the UK at the moment, and this one is about a gentleman called Mark Harris. He's just written a book, actually, Family Court from Hell. It would be an interesting book because his story is certainly interesting. He was denied access to his three children after his divorce. Mark was jailed for standing outside of his house to wave to them as the ex-wife took them to the school. It took 10 years and 133 court hearings before they were reunited. He's now got custody of the two of the children after 10 years. Mark was not a feckless, irresponsible father. He did not walk out on his children's lives. Rather, he was ordered out by the family courts, and when he objected, insisting that it was his right to see them, he was dealt with it in a scandalous way. Mark actually went to prison for his girls. He was jailed for waving to them after court order demanded he sever all contact. It was the most shameful chapter in an extraordinary 10-year custody battle. He has lived every father's worst nightmare, and every miserable step is etched on his face. You know, he's so angry about his experience that he's written this book, and surely my story, he says, is evidence enough that the system needs a change.
Well, we should try and get him on the air, actually. We'll see if we can get him on in the coming weeks.
We will be trying. He's got this new book out, Family Court Hell, and I think many people would be interested in that, so we hope to do that. We'll be back in a few moments with an interview with Adrian Burgess from the UK after this.
Never
On the phone from the UK, we have Adrienne Burgess. She's the author of Fatherhood Reclaimed, and she's the Policy and Research Advisor to Fathers Direct, the National Information Centre on Fatherhood in the UK. Adrienne, good morning.
Good morning.
Can you start off by telling us just a little bit about Fathers Direct, what Fathers Direct does?
Yes, Fathers Direct is it's a small charity. It's what you'd call a peak body, I suppose, in the sense that it is there to hold the issue of active fatherhood in the sense, working with government departments to help the government departments with when they're funding up allocations are given, to help them define what is active fatherhood, what is father inclusive practice, to look at the documents that they put out and work on those again to help define what's meant by that. Because once you get it into policy and into expectations, then it goes right across services. So we do that work, but we also then provide training and consultancy in the field.
Okay, so you're working both on at the very big end of things, influencing government policy before it's made, but also working on at the grassroots with actual training and running courses for fathers, is that
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely, that's exactly what we're doing. We don't work with fathers, though.
Okay, so who do you... you work with the services?
We're not an organisation for dads.
Right.
We work with service providers.
Right. And what are some of the sorts of service providers that you work with? Give me some examples of the programs you might be running at the moment.
Well, we run sort of introductory and advanced courses on father-inclusive practice. So it's not about setting up fathers' groups, though that can be a result. It can be that when people try to look at the service, it might be a children's centre, or it might be an antenatal service, it might be a child protection service. And they can all have different ways of approaching how they work effectively with dads. And sometimes in a children's centre, it might be appropriate to set up, say, a Saturday morning dads and kids club. But it's not about... Everyone thinks that when you work with fathers, it's about setting up groups for all these dads to sit and talk to each other. And actually, very few fathers will ever join a group. It's just not their thing. Lots of mothers will never join a group either. It's about making sure that teachers in a school will get the names of the fathers and the mothers, will specifically invite dads along so they don't just send letters home saying, dear parent. They preferably send letters home separately to the mother and the father, and if the father doesn't live at home, has his details on the database and information goes to him as well. So where there are safety issues, of course, or where there are injunctions and court orders stopping that, then of course that doesn't happen. But the normal run of events, which is 99 out of 100 dads.
Right. And obviously there was a need for this to start including dads. Is this because historically a lot of services that have dealt with children have... is it that they've been actively excluding fathers? Has there been a default paradigm where parents equals mothers? Why is there a need to sort of re-educate the services into including fathers?
Well, because childcare has always been seen as women's business. And so what you're shifting is generations, centuries of expectation that women will be in charge of children. In fact, in the 17th century, if you used the word parent, it actually meant father. Because the parent, the most important person was the father. Because the woman didn't own property separately
right.
from him.
Yep.
All those kind of things.
Mm.
It was very, very secondary. But then that has changed around so that as men have become the main breadwinners, and that's been a very much a move of industrialization, the men not just being main breadwinners but going out of the home to do that, then the women have taken a more central role in the home. And for a long time in early industrialization, that was actually a very good move, because babies died when women went into the factories to work because they couldn't go on breastfeeding.
Right. So there was a stage in our cultural evolution where these roles were appropriate, and we've moved on from that, and so we have to sort of change those roles.
That's right, yeah. Because what's happening in actuality, in real people's lives, is that fathers are doing far more childcare than their own fathers. They're not on a par with women yet. They're still, in many families, the major breadwinner. But women are increasingly in the workforce. You know, women are being, every year, you know, women coming through with higher education, higher earnings. But, you know, everything's changing. And so services are still working to the old paradigm. And so they have to be encouraged to catch up.
And have there been any moves by government recently that have, you know, what's the good news in the UK in terms of government change on this? I hear that recently there's an introduction of paternal leave, is that correct?
Paternity leave.
Yeah.
Yes, yes. Well, there is. Fathers in the UK get 2 weeks paid paternity leave. And mothers get, I think it's 6 months, and it's now just been extended to 9 months or a year. I'm slightly, not quite my field, so I'm not quite up on that. But women's maternity leave is now very substantial and paid for the first 6 weeks only at full salary, but after that at a much lower level, sort of income support level. And that's the level at which the men's 2 weeks paternity leave is paid. It's virtually nothing. It's about £112 a week.
Right.
But even so, huge numbers of fathers are taking this up, and lots of companies are topping up the fathers. You know, they're using that contribution by the government that's then giving him the rest that he would normally get. Lots of companies aren't doing that, but some big companies are doing that. So fathers are overwhelmingly taking paternity leave. But then in Australia, and rather than having to just use their holiday, because for many years now, fathers have been taking substantial time off around the birth of their children. That's been the norm in families, because fathers are needed at home in a way that they weren't before. Extended families aren't there. You know, older parents are often still in the workforce. Mothers, you know, the mother-in-law who would come along, and or the mother and help out, probably doesn't to the same extent. And young couples don't want that. They want to do it on their own. Far more fathers at home. So that's useful, but we have a very, very gender-differentiated approach here, where women get all this paid maternity leave and their jobs are secure. Fathers can take unpaid time off and their jobs are then secure. But there's no pay, so very few fathers can afford to do
that. Right, I mean, is that still, is that sort of confirming the notions of fathers as breadwinners and mothers as carers?
Completely. Yeah. And, you know, it's social engineering of the most ghastly kind, which actually penalises families who would like to do things differently. It doesn't allow them to do it. And in Australia, nobody has paid maternity. There's no statutory paid maternity leave, as we know. And the government, I know Labour's now talking about bringing in unpaid parental leave, which both mothers and fathers can have.
12 months
in fact,
each.
Australian parents, mothers and fathers, do already have a right to 12 weeks unpaid parental leave. So they already have that. But nobody takes this. Well, no men can take this because they're mainly the breadwinners around the birth of a child because the mother's literally incapacitated.
Right, and in a lot of families, dual-income families, then the father's taking on not only his normal workload but an additional workload to compensate for the loss of income of the mother who is no longer working.
Yes, I mean, that used to be the case, but we're now seeing that fathers are not working longer hours on average. Some are, around the birth of children. I think that's also the case in Australia, but I'm not absolutely convinced. It's certainly the case here. But I'm pretty sure that also we're finding in Australia, because there's such a strong sort of expectation now and wish by fathers to be more closely involved with their children. But couples seem to be kind of humbling along. And in Australia, you have got the baby payment, whatever it's called.
Right, the baby bonus.
Can cushion that a little bit.
Of course, in Australia and in England, one of the reasons that it's very important for fathers to have a greater involvement in the interest of their children before there is any separation, because once separation occurs, if they haven't had a lot of involvement with their children, then they get penalised by not having enough contact later.
Well, and also, you want the bonds of love to be strong enough to survive the family change, because all the evidence is quite clear that during during the breakdown period, when the couple are very unhappy and are increasingly separate or fighting a lot, fathers tend to be, if they disengage from their partners, as a lot of men do, they disengage, they're kind of stone wall, they disengage because they're scared of exploding, perhaps they they don't know how to handle it, they tend to just back off and close down in that period. And they tend also at that stage to back off and close down from their children, because that's part of the self-protection mechanism. So by the time parents have separated, the father-child relationship is often not nearly as good as it was before, and will need rebuilding afterwards. So what you want are very strong bonds of love. And so it's not just about the courts looking and saying, was he involved? So that's important too. But it's, the children help to dictate which time they spend with parents. Children help to dictate that. So you want the children very connected in with their fathers, so that for them, of course, it's natural that they go on spending a lot of time with their dad.
We're talking with Adrienne Burgess, the author of Fatherhood Reclaimed, and she's a policy and research advisor to Fathers Direct. She's one of the world's leading commentators on fatherhood. We'll be back in a moment.
What did I try?
We're talking with Adrienne Burgess from the UK. She's the author of Fatherhood Reclaimed and a policy advisor for Fathers Direct. Welcome back. Can I ask, how did you personally come to be interested in this policy field?
I'd been a journalist for a long time, and I'd written on couples, and I'd been a popular journalist. I used to write for Cosmopolitan as one of the core writers on that magazine and many other magazines. And then I started to drift into finding out about it academically. This is couples, and then interviewing experts so that what I wrote had a good evidence base. And then a publisher came to me, Random House, and said, if you'd like to write a book, we'd be very happy to publish it. And I said, well, what about fathers? Because I'd seen that there wasn't anything around. I didn't have children myself, but I'd had to write an article on something, and I'd noticed I wanted to look something up, and I thought, oh, there isn't a book, easy access book on this. And they said, well, yes, fathers, but we wouldn't want anything just on separated fathers or anything like that, because that's a niche market. We would like a book that would try to answer the big questions. So I sort of hung around for about 6 months thinking, what are they talking about? What are the big questions? Mm-hmm. And then a friend of mine said, well, Adrian, the whole thing. And I said, what do you mean the whole thing? And she said, well, everything, you know, history, anthropology. And then I thought, ah, yes, the big question is, how is father's behavior created? What are the forces that shape the ways men behave as fathers? So that one man will be highly involved, but the man next door won't be. You know, what's going on here? So then I had to actually look at how fathers do behave and then try to decide what's natural, in inverted commas, you know, what's biology and what kinds of social forces impact in what ways on fathers. And that's what my book, Fatherhood Reclaimed, did. It looked at how fathers have behaved in the past in northwestern Europe, and then it took a look across quite a lot of anthropological work. And you know, it was great. It opened my eyes, and I began to realise that the way fathers behave is very mutable. It can change a lot, and it depends how we encourage it, what support we give, how we picture the roles for fathers, you know, in how cultural roles are defined, whether men have to go away to war. If there's war, if a society is warlike, then fathers tend to be not very involved. You tend to have those situations where you hear about tribes having kind of initiation things for boys, where, you know, the children are in the care of the mother, and then at age 7 the boy is taken and initiated into the men.
Yeah.
These societies tend to have very split roles with very little involvement by fathers. And then what they're doing is training the boys to be separate from what is soft.
Did you find there was a sort of universality across the cultures? Or
No, completely diverse.
Completely?
Completely diverse. And there are many tribes, for example, who would never think of having an initiation ceremony for boys. And they tend to be... cultures, you know, tribes where the fathers have very high levels of involvement. There's a tribe called the Akar Pygmies, where the father is within arm's reach of his newborn for 47% of the time. You know, almost half the time he's within arm's reach of the child.
And is that because those particular cultures aren't threatened by war, or there's no need for the men to go off and, you know, fight and be killed? Did you find that there's some correlation there, that those cultures are somehow safer, and so the men are freed up to you know, develop that side of themselves?
That's right. I mean, that's absolutely right. That's now known to be, there's been quite a lot of work done looking at this, and this is one of the key things. It's that they're cultures that are not on the make. They're not expanding. They're not territorial. Right, so they are not trying to go out and conquer other lands. Often they're little tribes that are very much at the bottom of the heap. Nobody actually wants their land. But no one's really attacking them. And they are not, they're not thinking about going over and conquering next door. So they're just kind of living quietly.
Right.
They've got enough to live on. And they don't have any aspirations to move out. Once they start to, you see that in where families in these tribes start to want to try to move over and, you know, do a lot of business with the tribe next door and starting to actually expand, those families tend to develop more split gender roles.
So was there an evolution over history as well, as these things changed over time as well as in different locations?
Well, we have to kind of know that lots of stuff is hidden from history and we'll never get it back. You know, you wouldn't know for among tribes what that, you know, I've never seen it. Maybe there is some anthropological work that can trace back what has been and what has changed. I haven't ever seen any work done around that on fatherhood. It may have been it, but I haven't seen it. Where we can look is into our own, to our own culture, and we can go back with some fair idea of what's going on to the 18th century and a little bit into the 17th century. We can, but beyond that, the records are too limited.
Was that Pygmy tribe you mentioned the single most father-involved culture in the world?
The Akar Pygmies.
Yeah, and that's they're the single most involved fathers on the planet.
To be the stars of, but it's really interesting because when you look at the Akar, you think, well, hang on, is it just that they're not on the make? They're just like this little quiet tribe. It's partly that, but it's also that they're pygmies. Now, pygmy babies are born pretty much normal-sized babies.
Right.
Because that's nature makes it like that, otherwise they would die. So they're born much the same size as a baby whose parents are not pygmies. But what happens is the pygmy baby then grows. And the pygmy grows, it grows quite rapidly, so that at a very young age, it's actually quite a heavy baby for the pygmy mother to carry. And men have upper body strength. So it's natural in the Akar for the father to do a lot of the carrying, because the Akar hunt as a family. They hunt small animals, and they all go out, grandmothers and... You know, it's not. There's nobody much sitting around at home around the campfire. They go out as a family. They set up nets, the family net hunt, and then the children everybody run and frighten small animals into the net. And because the Akar fertility is quite high, and there's not people hanging around the campfire, they have to take the babies with them. And so the Akar pygmy dads carry the babies because of their upper body strength and the size of the babies. And therefore, because they just carry them a lot, of course they do a lot of the care, you know, wipe their bottoms and so on. And so the babies are very attuned to their dads, and the dads are very attuned to the babies, and the Akar are very proud. Akar males are very proud of their relationships with their babies. You know, they say, we love our babies.
And that 47% contact, what is the Western percentage of contact in that same period, for instance?
Well, father-child contact is pretty high, you know, compared with most tribes, because when you've got subsistence tribes where you've got, you know, men are going out hunting or going down, you know, travelling away, like in many very poor countries, the men are migrant workers, and so they're away, you know, or they're down the salt mines or whatever they're doing, they're needed to have these very distinct roles. So the post-industrial West is in a very good position to be for high father involvement, and higher father involvement is happening quickly. In England, for example, there's actually very high father involvement compared with more traditional southern European cultures like, Italy, Greece, those kind of cultures. So the northern European culture is more secular, less based around the extended family. When there's a big extended family, women switch in and do all the stuff. But Northern Europe has had this nuclear family actually for a long time, with lots of migration, people moving around around the country, even if they don't migrate between countries, moving around the country. And that pattern can be found in England, you know, right back to the 16th, 17th century. So you've had families quite reliant on the nuclear family. And when that happens, and, you know, grandparents are dead. You know, you don't have big extended families in pre-industrial Britain or in pre-industrial Europe because they're all dying. So you've had to rely on more care. And there's a little lullaby, actually, 18th century lullaby, which goes, hush, little babby, lie still with thy daddy. Thy mammy hath gone to the mill to get thee something like the wheat, to grind thee some meat. Hush, little babby, lie still. So, you know, the mothers, women have had their their trades. You know, whether it was making beer or whether it was being washerwomen or whether it was baking. You know, they've gone. They've always had these, and because you haven't had this huge extended family, it's quite likely that men in Northern Europe, from which of course a lot of Australia has come, have had quite high father involvement compared with many other places. And it's getting rapidly higher. The Australian data is very clear, the American data and the UK data, very, very rapidly faster per generation.
And we just need governments, I guess, to do some catching up. Do you have some comparisons with... I think Scandinavia has very progressive social policy from governments in terms of paternity leave and fatherhood and all of that sort of thing. Do you find that there's some differences there?
That's right. The Scandinavia, each Scandinavian country is different, and they're all driven by different motives. Sweden's been very much driven by women in the workforce and has and it's a very good way we focus at Fathers Direct, we have very strong, I mean, our driver is not men's rights or men's health or even particularly, you know, men's well-being. We are keen on men's well-being, but not in the same way as in Australia, where a lot of the work around men and fathers is driven around men, you know, let's be fair to men, let's make sure they're healthy, let's da-da-da. But we like that, of course, but our vision is very much more universal, child-centric for a start. So we don't look at, we're looking at what the child needs genuinely.
Right.
So we look at where fathering is very negative, which, of course, it is in a minority of cases, as is mothering. We look very much at working with social workers, not just to kind of keep kids in contact with their dads, but to be challenging behavior in fathers that's highly negative, of course. So, but a lot of work don't do that. I find it when I work in Australia and I'll talk to groups, they find it very hard to hear, especially if they've been working around men's issues. Very hard to hear me talk about, you know, very negative behavior by dads. But lots of dads are vulnerable. You know, they have drug and alcohol problems, they have mental health issues. And these vulnerable men, you know, have very negative impacts on their partners and children. So we have to deal with that as well. And that's very important.
Right.
And where mothers are concerned, as I said, in Scandinavia, the drive has been, how can we get more women in the workforce in better jobs? Oh my God, we've got to get the men helping out at home. That's how it starts. And then it starts, well, if they're going to help out, actually, they need to do more than that. They need to have equal responsibility. That's the only way it's going to work. if they're going to have equal responsibility, my goodness, they need to have rights. They need to have
right.
rights to parental leave.
So in a sense, you're almost removing gender from the issue and saying, you know, problematic parents, whether they're mothers or fathers, with substance abuse, with bad behaviour, you know, we have to address that and make those parents, whether they're mothers or fathers, better parents, and we need to give both men and women equal rights, responsibilities and opportunities. With that, you actually, it's almost removing gender from the equation altogether, except that our culture is still very gendered, so you're sort of... Mm. Yeah, does that make sense to that?
Yes, completely. And it is about... In the end, it's about working towards a place where gender... where everything is available to both sexes. And so gender is removed from the equation.
Right, and you obviously have...
Gender, yeah?
Sorry, and you obviously have strong research basis that shows that this is better for the kids, right?
Oh, absolutely.
And that's the place you're coming from.
There's absolutely no doubt about it.
Right.
Mm. There's no doubt about that. Look, single fathers can raise children and have and do every day of, you know, every day in Australia. There are dads out there who are raising children on their own without mothers and doing fine.
And in the UK too?
Single mothers doing fine. You know, children can survive many different family forms. There are children growing up in lesbian households who will do very well in life. There are children growing up in gay male households who will do very well in life. You know, children can cope with diversity. So it's not about saying, oh, we have to have fathers. It's just saying that if you put the child in the centre, every child, you know, measures themselves against all lives in their imagination, if not in reality, against the two people who made me.
We're talking with Adrienne Burgess, author of Fatherhood Reclaimed. She's on the line from the UK. We'll be back in a moment.
I love you, Daddy. I wish your pain would go away.
We're talking of Adrienne Burgess from the UK. She's the author of Fatherhood Reclaimed and a policy advisor for Fathers Direct. Welcome back. How have you noticed in the time that you've been involved the academic discourse around this subject changing?
It's changing. It's changing. It's changing slowly, though. And what it is that they do remove gender from the equation, so they think they're being inclusive. They talk about parents. But when you look at it, their sample is entirely mothers. Or they have got parents and mothers in the sample, but then they talk about parents, so they're not differentiating the experience of these very different groups. And
right.
So you don't actually, they're blind to what we call gender blind. They're gender blind. So even though we're moving towards getting gender out of the equation, you have to take highly gendered approaches.
Right, so it's not enough to change the language, because if you change the language from mother to parent, by parent you still mean mother, then you haven't changed anything.
That's right. So you have to get rid of that word parent most of the time.
Right, and talk about fathers and mothers.
Fathers and mothers. Right, and then you have to sometimes talk about other carers and father figures and And father figures and fathers are very different too. It's not enough to just say, oh, we're going to talk about fathers, and that means we go to see a family and there's a male there, and we don't ask whether he's the biological father or the social father, because it's significant what his role is. We need to know this.
Absolutely.
So we need to know, is there more than one figure around? If there's a father, let's say there's a father figure, a stepfather or mother's boyfriend living in a household, and the child's relating to him perfectly well, we still need to know what their relationship is, all kinds of legal reasons. We need to be able to, the child needs to know who the father is, because what the child will call my real dad, even if they love their stepdad more, they will still talk about my real dad, and they're quite right.
Mm.
They need to know who their father is for medical reasons, if nothing else.
Is there a political background to this in the UK? Do you find that the Conservatives are more sympathetic to fatherhood issues than the Labour Party, or vice versa?
No. The Conservatives are still stuck in the old paradigm of the white picket fence.
Right.
And talking about these men who must be responsible for their children. And they think they're talking about fatherhood, but they actually haven't got it at all. That this is because they're still thinking about much more differentiated approach to families, with these fathers having this role that they think is good for them, which is being breadwinner, which actually is what largely keeps them away from their children. So it's a really odd one. The Conservatives haven't got it at all. They talk, David Cameron, I'm an involved dad, I cook lunch for my children on a Sunday.
Yes. David Cameron, for those.
He's a very nice and lovely dad, actually, as I think Tony Blair is.
Yeah.
You know, I think Tony Blair and David Cameron are both very good communicators. Men who love their children and have been, for the kind of parents they are, very, high-achieving men, very involved fathers. I know for absolute sure that Tony Blair is really outstanding in lots of ways as a dad. It's completely hidden. Nobody knows except those who know him.
Right.
And it's really interesting. They don't... Men in power don't really know how to talk about their fatherhood.
Interesting.
And so that remains hidden. And that's one of the things that Fathers Direct is here to do.
That's one of the problems, isn't it?
And acknowledge and help men like that talk about their fatherhood in ways that reveal what's really going on in so many families.
That's an interesting problem, isn't it? The politicians don't know how to talk about fatherhood. They don't understand.
It's not surprising, because they're supposed to, industrialization has said you have to pretend there's nothing in the way of your work. The man must be available for industry all the time.
So the people responsible...
Shadow family meet his needs.
So the people responsible for changing and making laws don't really understand the big picture.
It's new. It's very new. But yet, we certainly don't take an oppositional stance on this.
No.
Because we recognise how hard it is for people to grasp this.
And so
it has to be an enabling stance. It's very exciting work. Because nobody understands what you're on about.
Well, we're running out of time here, Adrian. We just might ask finally, is the whole public discourse around this issue, is that changing as well?
It is changing. We've had less... yes, it is changing. It's changing. I noticed in Australia, and I come up quite often, and I lived there quite recently for a couple of years, and I noticed there's lots of stories about involved fatherhood starting to come out, because that's what's going on in people's families. But changing the public discourse is in our business plan for the next 5 years. So it's one of the things we are now starting, and we're starting a new information service for fathers, directly address families. Mm.
Fantastic. Well, it sounds like you've got your work cut out for you, and
yes.
Adrian, we wish you all the best with it, and thank you so much for taking the time to appear on Dads on the Air today.
It's been a great pleasure. And thank you for talking to me.
No, thank you from everyone in the studio.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Okay, thanks. Bye.
My dad said you got rocks in your head if you think you're gonna take the car tonight. My dad said you got rocks in your head. My dad said if you say why again, I'm gonna clip you around the ear. And I looked at him and I had to ask him why. My dad said I shouldn't cut my hair. Forget about the tats and the studs everywhere. I'd never get a girl without money on my own side. house and his wear. Now you stop around the house in his underwear. My dad said, him retirement when he turned 65. He said he'd rather work until the day he died. My dad said, if you have a go, then at least you'll know, and you won't die dreaming of what might have been. My dad said,
yes, well, everybody who's been reading the newspaper or having anything to do with the media over the last couple of weeks would not have been able to miss the fact that the federal government, or John Howard, the Prime Minister, has initiated a national emergency to deal with the perceived problems with mainly Aboriginal communities out in remote territories and in the Northern Territory, West Australia, and mainly South Australia, although there's a fair bit of it in Queensland as well, to do with child sexual abuse. And it would appear that this campaign has failed as a political manoeuvre, that most people tend to see this as a cynical move on the Prime Minister's behalf in an election year to grab votes, and that this fact of declaring the Aboriginal community situation to be a national emergency this far out of an election is actually a cynical vote-grabbing manoeuvre, which has shown up in the latest Galaxy poll, which has put Labor ahead 55 points to the Coalition's 45 points. So it would appear that this current campaign, even though we here at Dads on the Air do support any measures to improve the health and safety of Aboriginal children, especially against alcohol-ridden communities and sexual abuse, which is the greatest horror, the greatest scourge of our world today, we believe. So it would appear to have backfired.
Yes. Okay, I'll be away for the next month. I'm going to leave the show in the capable hands of the other three guys. I'm actually heading off to a couple of conferences where I'll be recording interviews for Dads on the Air. The first conference is it's a national conference in Washington DC in the States called Boys and the Boy Crisis. I'll be interviewing various American authors and men's issues commentators. Christina Hoff Summers, author of The War Against Boys. Matt O'Connor from Fathers for Justice. Warren Farrell, author of The Myth of Male Power. And Catherine Young, author of Spreading Misandry. So that should be great. I'm also off this week to the Working with Boys, Building Fine Men conference, all about boys' education. That's in Newcastle, Australia. And should get some good interviews. Now, next week we'll have John Baker from Families Need Fathers in the UK. And don't forget our web address, dadsontheair.net. And we'll see you next week on Dads on the Air. We're Dads on the Air.